Access number 27783, Mr. Doug Radcliffe, Real 5. Now, how long were you in hospital for? Was it just a matter of days, or was it...
No, I was in there probably about... I recall about 2 weeks. Then I went for convalescent up to Tel Aviv.
What do you remember about that?
Well, it was fine. Lovely, marvellous time. We were really looked after. There's a convalescent camp on the top of the hill at Tel Aviv. And what made it better, after I'd been there about a week, Neville arrives. Neville Hadley. So the others were still stuck in Almaza. So that was great, you know, to have Neville up there. And we had a really good time up there.
And then what?
And then we went back to Almaza with the crew. And then one day we were told we're going up to join a wing in Karawan, North Africa. And
so the Middle East, the Far East thing was cancelled?
Yeah, yeah. And then we went down in a flying fortress, which was an interesting experience.
Why? What was...
Well, to fly an American plane, you know, during the war.
You actually flew... Were you just passengers in
it? Oh, yeah, we were just passengers. Not just us, but there were another... I think it was another crew.
And what did you think of the flying fortress?
Smashing. You know, I thought it was very, very... Totally different, you know, totally different aeroplane.
So, you were going to Karawan?
That's right, yeah.
And who were you joining there? What was the name of the wing?
425 Squadron.
Just RAF?
Yeah, RCAF.
Ah, Royal Canadian Air Force.
Yeah, they were French-Canadian.
And how did they make you welcome? You were coming in, you were obviously an existing crew, and not French-Canadians, are you?
Yeah.
What sort of reception did you get?
Quite good, you know, we were rather surprised. There were two or three other complete English crews there, but many of the Canadian crews would have perhaps an English bloke flying with them.
Was it very obviously a French-Canadian unit, though? I mean, was that the overall tenor of it?
Oh, yeah, they were the Alouettes, and they were highly charged, highly motivated. I mean, if they weren't on the battle order for an operation that night, they'd fight amongst themselves. They were, you know, a nice crowd of chaps, really good. Yeah.
And so, they all made you welcome?
Yeah.
And you seem to have started your operations almost straight away. I mean,
yeah.
A week or so later.
Yeah.
You had another Wellington, I presume.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
The first flight seemed to be related to...
The invasion of Sicily,
which is going on then.
Yeah.
What do you remember about these? These are your first operational flights.
Yeah.
What do you remember of those first flights?
Well, I remember the invasion of Sicily as... What I remember is suddenly you are in a different sphere of the war. I mean, I never flew over Germany at all, but you would simulate flights over Germany, over England, where you get to 18,000 feet, puffing away oxygen. Now, over there, we didn't even bother about oxygen. I never wore an oxygen mask all the time I was out, because we were... I suppose you could call us army cooperation. We were following the armies up, and there were no great cities that you attacked or anything like that. You were given areas to attack, and that was it. It seemed to be, as the armies moved forward over out of Sicily and into Italy, your targets changed to Italy again. So. It was a totally different thing, but the worst night I remember was that invasion of Sicily, because everything seemed to be... I think everybody was shooting at everybody else, and you had the Royal Navy, the United States Navy, the Canadian Navy, the Wehrmacht, the Italians, the Army, everybody's all shooting anything that moved in the air, and there was some... You know, tragedies we learned afterwards. They were even shooting down their own gliders into the sea, and many men were lost that way. So I don't think we did anything very successful that night. We bombed, but it was...
Do you know what your targets were?
Very vague in many cases, very vague. I mean, I think I recall you used to get an army chap at the briefings in some cases, and he'd give you some idea of where the marks were, but that would be a navigator's briefing that the wireless ops and the gunners wouldn't go to, you know.
Now, what's the next thing you remember? You seem to have done two over Sicily and then one over Naples.
Yeah.
And then San Giovanni, and then Italy starts up, you know, Salerno, all that around the area. Well, any of these flights you remember in particular?
Well, this is where the period whereby we were not functioning very well as a crew.
Now, what was the problem?
Well, Harry, the navigator. You know, we were finding that... Well, basically, we were getting lost and not coming back and groping around for the target. And this is a dangerous sort of situation. If you're not in on the right time at a target, you're sitting duck left on your own. And Harry was grounded. Not LMF. He was still keen to fly, but the capability, I think, had left him to be a good navigator with a crew and that sort of responsibility. So the crew was grounded. And if you look at my logbook, I then started to fly as spare WOP with just about anybody who had a wireless operator who was sick.
It's entirely... So you were... you're flying with Blakeney, Smalley, Richard, White, just anybody.
Yeah.
Now, what was it like being a spare wireless operator? I mean, is there a problem not being in a crew?
Yeah, there is.
What's the problem?
Well, the problem is that you are not in a crew. You're suddenly flying with somebody who you've never flown with before. And you sense that they don't really want you there, but they've got a wireless operator who is sick. You know, and you get sort of the feeling that you're not, you know, undesirable, unwanted, but part and parcel of the game. Sorry, but I didn't enjoy that. I think I went and saw the CO and said that I wasn't happy about this situation. And he said, okay, well, and he put it right, and then I suddenly flew with Squadron Leader Richet, which was another ball game. It's different now because he was the flight commander and a very strong man. He became the CO. So that was indeed an honour for me to fly with him.
Now, what was Squadron Leader? Do you remember his name, his first name? I suppose you'd use it much.
No, but I have it somewhere.
Okay, we'll perhaps add that. So, yeah. Squadron Leader Richard, what was he like?
A smashing man. Really good. And a very natural flyer, you know. He flew in peacetime in Canada before the war. And he became the CO. And he looked after me, you know. You'll notice at the end of this... operation over there, I was suddenly tour expired, which was something that came as a surprise to me, because normally you have to do either 30 operations. They did things like how many hours you did, and it became a different kettle of fish. And he came back to UK.
Now, before we come back, can we look at a typical operation from that time? You know, just to pick up all the sort of things of what it was like. I think it, probably for ease, if you pick one when Squadron Leader Richard was in charge, you know, was your pilot.
Yeah.
Now, if we take it from right from when you'd be first notified that you had an operation, when would you be told and how would you be told that you had an operation that day or night?
Your duty was to go to the briefing tent and look at the battle order. Okay?
Now, what's the battle order? Is that just
that tells you how many crews are going, okay? and what time the briefings were. You go into a big marquee for the briefings. Those briefings were split up like they were in this country, where you had the navigators, pilots, navigators, okay. And you didn't have any engineers on Wellingtons, incidentally, so that wasn't, they weren't.
So you wouldn't have a joint briefing, you just
yes,
a
separate, yeah. Right, oh, sorry. Yeah. Oh, yes, oh, yes.
Okay. Yeah, now, let's so you have the separate briefing first.
Yeah, then you have the main briefing.
Now, tell me what the separate, what would you be briefed on as a wireless operator gunner?
I wouldn't be briefed on anything, but the signals officer would come at the main briefing and brief you on the availability of beacons, what you had to listen out for, what channel, just simple material that you would be given in this country. Very much the same. But, of course, the facilities here, compared with the facilities in the UK, well, hardly there. I can't remember ever giving the navigator any worthwhile information.
Now, were you shown maps or photographs of the targets, or would that be in a separate bomber?
No, that would be the main one.
And what type of targets were you mainly going for?
Well, you'd pick out the target. Obviously, we felt we were following armies. We were following our army, and the nearest point of attack would be that. And wireless ops, we were told, you know, that information coming through would never ever change a target area, because, and a couple of the flight commanders were concerned about this, because they said, well, you know, say our troops move on faster than we anticipate, what are we doing? Well, you know, and apparently our targets were well in advance of any possible advance up to that area.
And what sort of targets were there? They weren't built up areas, were they?
No.
Were they? Concentration of troops or what?
Yeah, well, in many cases they were sort of lat long areas where you had to attack. And you had a not so much a clever pathfinder group out there, but you certainly had people who would be chosen to go in and mark an area, a target area.
Now, so you get your brief. What happened after the briefing?
You had a spell of nothingness where you waited, hung around.
About how long would that be?
Might be 2 hours. Maybe less sometimes.
Would you have done a test flight, or did you test fly your aircraft before you went?
Not generally speaking, no. No, not generally speaking. I mean, over here you always did. But, no, and there was always...
And what about the preparations of the machine? Would that be going on during the 2 hours?
Oh, yeah.
Now, I know you wouldn't be involved in that, but yeah. Can you talk a bit about the role of the ground crew in preparing the machine? Was it an important role?
Well, I think it was the most important. I can't think of anything more important. I mean, it is as important, if not more important, the actual trip, you know, to get that aircraft, particularly in those conditions, to run, to make sure the turrets were sand free, make sure the gears were perfectly okay. I mean, I think those ground crews, and particularly the chaps who had to bomb up, you put 18 250 pounders onto the winch, onto a Wellington, the work that's entailed, not only to get them up, to get them from the bomb dump, you know, and then you are working in conditions, because they were doing this in the day. We were mostly operating at night. I don't think there's any, we did a couple of daylights, but this is the work that goes on. And of course it goes on around the clock from the moment the aircraft lands.
Did you have a close relationship with your crew? I mean, your fitters and ground crew? I mean, did you know they were?
No. No idea.
So it sort of, they just did it for you, but that was it? You didn't sort of mix with them or meet them?
No.
Now, so they're preparing the plane, you're having a 2 hour break. What would you do in your 2 hour break or whatever hour, you know?
Well, there would be... you'd be surprised, you'd get a little bit of entertainment, you know. Sometimes you would get a record session, and I remember the Padre would have a Padre service, and the only way you could go to the Padre's, the only way you could go and see the film they had that night was to go to the Padre's service, so you're a little bit coerced into making sure that you praise the Lord before you saw the film. But, there was a tent there where they had bits and pieces. They made up citrus juice, you know, and borrowed the ice from the Americans, and it was, you know, there were things to do. Individual tents would have wind-up gramophones, and
What would you be getting ready yourself? I mean, your uniform, your flying kit, and rest. Would you put that on at this stage, or would you have your meal first?
You'd have your meal, and then you would.
Was it a special meal? Because you know, there's always a in this country. Yeah, it was a special meal.
No. There was nothing special. Nothing. You couldn't have it, could you? You know, no facility for it. And you've got to bear in mind another thing that you had. You're in shorts and a shirt. So the change is not just a question of getting into flying kit. It's getting into something long trousers. At least. So in other words, you'd revert back to your battle dress.
Now, what would you wear? Take me through everything you wear, your flying kit and the helmets and all the rest of it, the gloves, all of it.
Well, not to be pessimistic, but the thing is, you've got to think, if anything goes wrong, what am I going to have? So you need, okay, your flying kit that you're issued with, and that is heavy-duty socks, okay, silk underwear, okay, issued. And on top of that, your battle dress. The first thing you put on is your Mae West, and then you've got your harness. You've got harness, Mae West to go on. You've got you had flying gloves, but you never used them. Pilots sometimes use them, but a wireless operator could never use them.
You know? Bare hand.
Yeah. And also bear in mind that the moment you got to a couple of thousand feet, it's bloody cold. Although you're in the desert, it's just as cold up there as it is over here.
But you still didn't wear, because they did wear gloves from the European mission. I mean, you didn't wear them.
I never wore any gloves, no.
We'll come back to the temperature in the plane. So what else did you have? A flying kit? What about helmet?
You had a KD helmet, okay? You didn't have to wear that, but it was issued.
Would that have the built-in?
Oh yes, exactly the same, only it was made of a light cloth. And also, you had, of course, the same microphone, same system, exactly the same.
So, what happens next then? You've had your meal, you've got your kit on.
Yeah. You take your bag, a database, whatever you had, Psycho machine. I don't ever remember using that out there, but you took it, and you'd settle in the aircraft, go out to the aircraft.
Would that be far away from where you
could be? Wherever aircraft you were, you'd go on a van and be dropped off there, and you'd hang around outside, okay, and wait. As I recall, we wait for a Vary to go get airborne. And I often recall, I can't remember a night where the padre didn't come round. Just to say, okay, I'll give you some Hershey bars, you know, that was it.
Was that important to you? Because you weren't as religious as you had been, or your parents had been, you know.
Yeah.
What was the padre saying? Was it important? And, you know,
it was important to us to know that he flew on a couple of trips.
He actually flew on?
Yeah, he actually flew.
So he was quite an important figure to you.
He was, yeah. And when I say if you wanted to watch the film, you had to go to his service. You know. You didn't have to, but you did. It was good. They used to have some records of the hymns and that. They'd join in.
So what about getting into the machine and, I presume, checks before takeoff? I know the ground crew probably done it, but I presume...
Everything, yeah. Check everything.
When would you get on get in your aircraft?
Straight away, okay. Straight away when you knew that you were going, and you'd be called up by a flash to get the end of the runway, and you'd take off in turn.
Now, what checks would you do before takeoff?
You'd check your wireless that it was working, and it was my job to check with everybody in the crew on the intercom. Now, also, my job was not just to check their sitting positions, where the pilot sits, where the navigator is, but there are also plugs right through the aircraft in different positions. So you had to check that they worked as well. Because if anybody moved down the aircraft and plugged in, he would expect to have access to that TR9 system, which was the intercom. So you had to clamber around. I mean, very seldom use the front turret, very seldom. But you had to get and check it out anyway. So you had to clamber into that and check that plug as well.
So that was your job. That's what that, you checked. Yeah, anything else you'd check?
Well, just make sure that all the circuits were working okay. That was that. Was
the
it.
Wireless and everything.
Just a question.
What would they, the rest of the crew, be checking?
Well, they'd check their own job. The moment the pilot, okay, would be up with the bomb aimer, checking that, checking fuel, checking, doing a pilot's check, which is a hell of a list, you know, to do it properly. I'm not saying everybody did it, you know, the more experienced guys would, you could always tell at OTU the type of experience that went in. I used to watch the aircraft taking off and you could tell that here is a pupil taking off, because the aircraft would line up at the end of the runway and go down with the tail wheel still down, and off it would go. You knew when there was a pro on there, you know, he'd get to the end of the runway, wouldn't even be straightened up on the runway, and the engines would whirr, and the air gunner's airborne. He's up, you know, he's ready, he's getting the brakes off and the nose is down. You could tell this type of flyer, you know. And
what was the takeoff like for you then? Well, I presume Richard was one of those, was he?
Oh, yeah.
So what was the takeoff like?
Well, it was a feeling, well, here we go, that's it, let's get it off right. And once that, it was a good feeling, you know, it was a good feeling. Not as good a feeling as landing back, but...
Go back to that. Yeah. Now, when you took off, what was the routine on the flight? I mean, because in Europe, that's Europe as well, in the bombing over Germany, they flew as a stream, didn't they? Not as a formation.
That's right.
Did you fly as a stream or were you a formation?
Never in formation.
So what? How did you fly?
Just got up and set course for the target. That was it. And, of course, you weren't just one squadron. There were five or six or seven squadrons at Karawan in that there. So you had a lot of aircraft all taking off from different areas. When I say different areas, to walk from one squadron to another, which I did one day, took me something like 2.5 hours. A foolish thing to do. I took my water bottle and I thought, well, I'll go and see that 142 boys that I was with at Waltham. They were out there. I knew them all, and I foolishly started to walk.
Now, I'll come back to that. Your individual aircraft within a bomber stream made up of possibly, three, four, five, six squadrons sometimes. I mean,
yeah.
One thing people don't understand is how you avoid collisions. You know, it's night. You're not flying in formation. You're flying by your own courses. The courses could easily run to you. How did they avoid collision, or was it?
You said easily. Not much chance of that. I don't think there was ever any thought given to this. You've seen the official reports about when they did the 1,000 bomber raid, how many aircraft they expected to prang into one another. You know, it was very few indeed. It's a big area up there, you know. I remember one day, probably in the logbook there, we took off quite early, so we were indeed sort of flying out until it got dusk together, because we could see one another, and obviously, because you could see one another, they all kept together. But directly it got dusk, you never saw another aircraft.
Right, so what was the routine in flight then, for you and for the crew, but for you in particular, which that's your best... What you're on your way out, you've got, well, some of these flights are 7 hours, so you must have 3 or 4 hours going out.
Yeah.
What was the routine in that 3 or 4 hours?
Well, I would have a job to listen to a base broadcast.
Now, what's that?
At a certain time. The base is broadcasting any information that you require. Okay? Maybe a change of wind, very few that sort of information out there. Okay? Maybe a change of target, maybe a BBA, that is a signal for return to base. that was the one you'd like to get, but you never did, you know. That was BBA, return to base. But having left, having done that signal and let the navigator and well, everybody in general know that there's nothing on the base, you go back and give the crew another pair of eyes. And my job was in the Astrodome, just looking round, waiting to see what happened, and you report on anything you see, and you report if there was flak to starboard, you report it, and how many miles away it was, and if it was starboard or anything, you just report anything that you could see, and then you would go back to your set to just make sure that everything's going.
Now, would anything much be happening during your trip out?
No.
Was there much risk of fighter interception, German fighter interception, or Italian fighter?
Well, this is what you're looking for all the time. You know, you were looking for this. And when I flew with Tex Blakeney, the reason I flew with him is because they were shot up, okay, and their wireless operator was badly wounded. So there was fighter activity, and we were never attacked. In fact, we never even saw an enemy aircraft.
But that was the risk.
Yeah.
That was what you were looking for.
Oh, yeah.
Now, what about anti-aircraft fire? You know, was there much of that?
It's a question of where you were. You know, if you went to a place where there was a concentration of troops, you would get anti-aircraft fire. But nothing compared with what I understand the Ruhr Valley, where Essen and the whole Ruhr would open up on you. You know, nothing compared with that. It was a very direct fire. And bear in mind where you're talking about over Europe, you were flying at 15,000 to 20,000, 25,000 feet. Over there, it was 3,000 feet, so you're liable to get shot up by a light flak.
What about searchlights? Would that be the same if there were searchlights?
Very few searchlights. Very few.
Now, what about this flight? You did talk to me a bit about the way you would fly at 3,000 feet, would you?
Well, not three, maybe four, five. You know, it was a question of what you would be advised to fly at the briefing. But there's one thing.
But generally, yeah. It was much a third of what the height.
Oh, did. Yeah, never went on oxygen all the time I was out there, not once, or anybody. You know, I mean, you're talking about 10,000 feet. But
which is half, you know,
yeah,
at least.
Yeah.
So now, what happens when you start to get? What's the process as you start to get near the target? I presume you start looking out more and more for fighters. But you tell me, what as you start to get near the target, what does everyone start doing?
Well, you now hear the bomb aimer. Okay, he's got jobs to do. Check his switches. Check everything. Okay. Check that the bomb doors, the hydraulics are going to be okay, the system is there, and no more. But you just mentioned the fact that you would get more intense to watch out over the target. That intensity starts when you get airborne. It's no, you know, just because you're getting near a target doesn't necessarily mean you're going to cop it there. You cop it anywhere.
So the level of vigilance was the same.
Yeah.
So I was completely wrong, right? I mean, that's an important point.
And furthermore, one of the places where vigilance is so important is over your own aerodrome, because they know where you are, and what a perfect place to get in amongst a group of aircraft that are taking
off.
We'll
come back to that when we go. So you're approaching a target. Where would you be on your wireless or what?
If I was
in the Astrodome.
In the Astrodome.
Yeah. And what happened when you actually reached it? What's the next thing?
Well, you would start to run in on the target, and this, by now, the pilot is almost taken over by the bomb aimer, who then instructs the pilot, the bomb doors are open, and he's on course to the target. He has decided what the target, where the target is, what it's going to be. He corrects the pilot going up to the target, and then he says, now, bomb's gone, that's it. And the bombs would be dropped.
Did that make a difference to the aircraft?
if you had a cookie on, you had a £4,000 on a Wellington, yeah, you had a lift. Yeah. But if they had the 18 250s, as they plumbed out, it was very little.